From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Today I'll talk with Thomas Finger. In the months leading up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, the Bureau of Intelligence and Research analyst cast doubts on whether they had nuclear weapons.
The question that was, give us a bill of particulars of all that has been reported about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. That's very different than a question that is, what do you think he has?
But first, I'll talk with Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis about President Obama's meetings with his counterparts in Russia and China to discuss cybersecurity and renewed tension in Syria.
We have a common interest, which is ISIS. And that's what he's trying to use to take the floodlight off of Ukraine, shift it over to Syria, where we do have some common goals.
That's all coming up right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz, we're all here together. And Joshua, I want to start with you, Syria-related, but President Obama is meeting with Russian President Putin to discuss his interest in supporting Syria. Now, of course, we're fighting the Islamic State, and we should be fighting Assad. I guess, you know, we don't like Assad. We're trying to convince Russia to not support Assad. This is what they've been doing, sending planes, tanks, troops, support to Syria. So what is the dynamic here, and how are we ever going to convince Vladimir Putin and Russia to not support Syria?
Well, that's a very good question. And as you say, the Russians have sent lots of new planes, helicopters, and other equipment to Syria. They're really going all in to support Assad and make sure he doesn't fail. He's become weaker. He's lost ground over the last year. They're trying to shore him up, but they're taking advantage of American confusion right now and trying to set the agenda for Syria, because the U.S. has pursued at least three different policies to try to build up moderate rebels to fight ISIS and Assad. All of those have failed spectacularly. Most recently, we sent in 60 guys trained and equipped. They all disappeared. So we don't know what to do. We've got no partners in Syria. The three major powers, ISIS, Assad, and this Jaish al-Fatah, which has al-Qaeda's heart, we don't like any of them. So Russia's saying, look it, support my guy, Assad. We need to decide, we need to all go in together, stop ISIS, support the government of Syria to take it over. Then the refugees will stop, theoretically, is his argument. And he's making a big move and a bold move. And it's unclear whether President Obama will want to get into an escalating, you know, try to outbid Russia and China. What for? America's got very few interests. And this is the quandary that he's in right now.
Right. But the working with Russia is not going to be easy, right? We've been isolating them over their actions in Ukraine. We, you know, of course, isolated them over their acceptance of Snowden and the allowing him to have seek exile in Russia. So, I mean, are they even going to – is it possible that they're going to be able to work together here? Do they really have common interests?
We have a common interest, which is ISIS. And that's what he's trying to use to take the floodlight off of Ukraine, shift it over to Syria, where we do have some common goals.
Well, this seems to play right into Russia's hands in some ways. All right. So let's pivot to China, Rebecca. So the United States and China are having some interesting discussions. So President Obama and President Xi Jinping from China are meeting this week to discuss an arms deal for cyberspace. This is kind of the first of its kind, an agreement to not use cyber weapons, to not be the first to use cyber weapons to attack each other's infrastructure, things like medical care facilities, cell phone towers, banking systems, power grids. Tell us about this move, and can we see kind of a new code of conduct emerging along these lines between these two countries and perhaps others?
Well, it's very hard to say. This is obviously early days. As you said, this is one of the first, if not the first, such agreement that they're working on. And this really comes from the larger issue of the cybersecurity, the ability to tap into some of these infrastructural issues, perhaps the new avenue in which we conduct war going forward. The Chinese president was on the West Coast earlier earlier in the week to talk with businesses from the United States, so Microsoft, Apple, and some others, who are particularly concerned about investing in China because it's becoming very difficult. And so he made promises to them saying that it will be easier. But the thing that they're most concerned about is intellectual property. And this new or potentially new agreement between China and the United States does not include intellectual property. And that's one of the areas that the Chinese government and non-government officials within China have been accused of tapping into or taking. So that remains a very big issue and will continue to be a concern. And then on the other side of things, of course, the Chinese government has claimed that the U.S. government has also been getting into their infrastructure as well as some of their intellectual property right over the internet.
Well, the fact is both of the countries, or at least people, individuals, groups in both countries, are constantly attacking each other in with cyber activity every day. I mean, are they even going to be able to control these kinds of activities? I mean, we're talking government to government, but there are lots of other players here, too.
Well, and that's the big question. Government to government, perhaps, although that's going to be some doing as well. But it's a much larger can of worms. This may be the first start. We'll see. And hopefully, if it is, then we can continue to build on that. But a first step.
Well, very interesting discussions in Washington this week. Thank
Absolutely.
You both very much for being here. If you have any comments about this discussion or questions for me, Rebecca, and Joshua, leave them in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. There you'll find all of our past episodes and a link to subscribe to our weekly podcast from iTunes. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter, at Suzette Verlot and at Joshua_Landis, where he tweets links to his widely read blog, Syria Comment. After a short break, I'm joined by Thomas Finger. He's a longtime intelligence analyst who cast doubts on claims Iraq had weapons of mass destruction leading up to the 2003 invasion. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. My guest this half hour is Thomas Finger. His career in foreign affairs has spanned decades, both in academics and public service. He was an assistant secretary of state and the head of the department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research in 2004 and 2005, where he was a chief advisor to Secretaries of State Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice on intelligence issues. He's also the author of the 2011 book, Reducing Uncertainty, Intelligence Analysis and National Security. Thomas Finger, welcome to Worldviews.
Delighted to be here.
So, Thomas, you've had a long career in the field of foreign affairs, foreign service officer, a lot of background and experience in the intelligence world. And, of course, many of us are always curious about the intelligence world. Much of what we know about the intelligence community comes from watching television or film, 007 or whatever. So inherently, that is an area of work that is very secretive, clearly. There's not much maybe we can know about it. There are a lot of things that go on that we don't know and understand. So tell us, first of all, like, how can we know? What do we know? And how can we know much about the intelligence community? How can we study it? You've written a book about it. Tell us a little bit about what we can know.
Well, actually, there's a great deal that one can know. That some of the collection methods, the very, very small percentage of activity classified as covert action, is secret and properly stays secret for a very long time. The analytic products that are done are born classified, no matter what the sources of information, because otherwise they would be the official views of the United States government. And the whole purpose of intelligence is to provide information and insights that will inform the decision-making process. And if those views, those judgments about the intentions and the actions of other countries or particular leaders were to be made public, you're not going to get a frank assessment.
So tell us a little bit more about collection methods. I'm particularly interested in something you said in your book in particular, Reducing Uncertainty, about intelligence analysis and national security, that the intelligence community can be affected by the political context and that then shapes you know, what they do. So how is it that, I mean, because to me, it seems like intelligence should be kind of the gathering of the situation, you know, describing a situation, gathering of the facts, if you will. But how is it that politics comes into play and influences how intelligence analysts go about collecting information and then using it after they've analyzed it?
The starting point for me is that intelligence is a support function in the United States government. It's not a policymaking function. It supports those who make policy decisions. That it, collection-wise, it vacuums up a lot of information. In theory, it has access to and collects all of the information that are collected by academics, journalists working on a subject. Most of what is collected is open and available. It also has access to diplomatic reporting, attaché reporting, and it has the ability to go in search of information, either through open polling data, diplomatic questions of foreign counterparts where they know they are speaking to the United States government, or clandestine collection. Where you have a source or you're intercepting a relatively small percentage of the total. But the idea is to gather as much information as one can on the subject. But it isn't simply a matter of collect all the information in the world and sort through it and see what it has to say. That it's support for American policy and the problems that are vexing, troubling U.S. decision makers, executive or occasionally legislative branch. So what the intelligence community goes after is driven in a substantial extent by what the policy issues are. It's not academic research where you explore the questions where you know you have enough information or it's just intriguing to one and there are no time limits on it. This is information and analysis with a goal, and the goal is to provide informed, insightful, timely, and targeted input that gets at the needs, the concerns of policymakers. It's not giving them what they want. It's giving them what the analyst that they are working with feels they need. They think that their understanding is incomplete or inaccurate to help them to understand how to put it in perspective and the like. So it's influenced by the policy agenda. The policy agenda is influenced by where an administration is in its term, what the legislative calendar is, what the objectives are being pursued. It's not pandering to give them the answers they want. It's to work on the issues that they think they need to address.
That's Thomas Finger, a longtime State Department official and high-ranking intelligence officer. We've been talking about how intelligence gathering can be affected by the contemporary political climate. And we'll pick up with that conversation right after a short break. I'm Suzette Rolat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Rolat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. I've been talking with Thomas Finger, a former Assistant Secretary of State who led the Bureau of Intelligence and Research during the George W. Bush administration. When we left off, we were talking about some of his research methods and intelligence gathering techniques. I like how you put that it's a process of vacuuming up a lot of information and that it's influenced clearly by a policy agenda and has certain goals. But might this influence then, I mean, because I think about gathering information and then sometimes, you know, you have to interpret what that information means and what's important and what isn't. And the outcome is I might focus on some things and not on others. And so I assume that this is true for intelligence analysts as well, and that as you go through the process of gathering this information, analyzing it, that what comes out on the other side is perhaps that you've emphasized certain things like threats, for example, as opposed to emphasizing areas where we can overcome problems or opportunities to address threats. Is that an accurate portrayal of that?
Mostly, but not entirely. That tasks of intelligence, as I and many others interpret them, are three. One is to anticipate threats, provide warning, ideally provide strategic warning, by which I mean alert policymakers while they have time to do something about the problem. that it does very little good to tell people in 20 seconds there's going to be a problem. So looking out to anticipate where events are headed, what is driving them, and where intervention might be helpful. A second is to reduce uncertainty, that the issues that policymakers grapple with most of the time are very complex, and the short time frames that are involved, that if it's a problem and they wish they knew 20 things about it and think they know three, if you can provide input on any of those 17 others, you've helped. You've reduced the possibility space. You could say this is – yeah, it's still possible but very unlikely because, or these are more likely because. So you help increase the comfortable – their understanding of the issue, how comfortable they are as they make a decision. The more neglected responsibility is to identify opportunities, for policy intervention to achieve a particular goal. This is tricky because the policy – the intelligence community is enjoined, prohibited by law from making policy recommendations and from directly commenting on U.S. policy. If you identify an opportunity, that comes pretty close to saying the current policy of the United States might be changed. So there is a reticence from the intelligence side to do that. There is great receptivity from the policy side. I would love to have a dollar for every time a policymaker said to me one way or the other, all you guys ever bring me are problems. Why can't you ever bring me an opportunity?
But yet it's difficult to do that because of the change that's involved, perhaps.
It is difficult to do it because an opportunity to do what? And as soon as you get into the do what, if it is a part of the policy agenda of the official, the administration, then you are supporting, promoting policy in a way that is outside the bounds that have been set.
Rather than analysis, providing just the analysis.
Correct. It makes the analyst appear to perhaps be not objective, to have a special agenda.
Well, I want to ask a question about the national intelligence estimates. You've written about this in your book. And if I recall correctly, these intelligence estimates became quite famous or infamous, shall we say, during the days of providing information leading up to the war in Iraq or prior to 9/11, really. I mean, there were some national intelligence estimates that were reportedly been ignored or overlooked or hadn't really perhaps made the case strongly enough about the threat that we were facing prior to 9/11, and then the way in which they were used in the coming months and years, if I remember correctly. Tell us a little bit about these estimates and how useful they are in providing the kind of information that our leaders need to make decisions on day-to-day issues, but also to prevent, hopefully, really important things from happening like 9/11, 2001.
National intelligence estimates represent one kind in a very small minority of the analytic products of the intelligence community, even the analytic products of the National Intelligence Council. The genesis of estimates and of the National Intelligence Council it dates from an era when the constituent agencies were more isolated, separate, independent than they are today. So the National Intelligence Estimate was an organized effort to draw upon the expertise and the insights of all of the relevant components of the intelligence community. It was one of the few ways that you would assemble all of the normal suspects on an issue and have them work on that collaboratively. In the years since intelligence reform, which is to say of the last decade, interaction among analysts from all of the agents is the norm. So intelligence estimates are just one form. They often are requested by officials who want to have the best judgment, the consensus judgment, or to know what the alternate judgments are of analysts working an issue or on an issue that is coming up for decision. Sometimes they are, we haven't looked at that in a systematic way. We ought to do so because either analysts or policymakers are uncomfortable making statements that are based on now dated information or analytic judgments. After the Iraq WMD estimate, the infamous flawed document, which I am in part responsible, I represented the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, even though we were the dissenting agency on that part of this process. Estimates became a political stick in sort of partisan politics in Congress versus the executive branch. You didn't ask for a national intelligence estimate. Well, didn't think one was necessary, or the White House didn't think one was necessary, or we want to have the judgment address our question. And what question is asked, as the same in the academic realm, determines the focus of what the answer is. And on the Iraq estimate, for example, the question that was, give us a bill of particulars of all that is known or all that has been reported about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. That's very different than a question that is, do you think he has reconstituted? What do you think he has? And so the question shapes the answer to this. The process by which estimates are produced, get the question right. What's the question that if you can answer it gives you the most insight into a particular problem? Do you have the answers to the prior questions that you would need? Do you have the information that you would need to answer that question in the time available? If not, can you get the information in order to meet the deadline? So it's not an open-ended, I'll write a dissertation on this however long it takes. It's that you've got 2 weeks, you've got 2 months. So you try to reduce uncertainty, add to clarity about the by asking the right questions and bringing to bear the right information and acknowledging analytic differences.
Well, I think you've painted a very interesting picture for us where we've gone from perhaps thinking about the intelligence world being so secretive we can't know much about it to what we do know is that it's very complicated and that it isn't always right. Sometimes it's flawed and sometimes it's pointed and directed in certain ways. But nonetheless, Thomas Vingar, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
You've been listening to my conversation with Thomas Vingar, the former Assistant Secretary for Intelligence and Research at the U.S. State Department. You can read the first chapter of his book, Reducing Uncertainty, Intelligence Analysis and National Security, on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews as part of a partnership with the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Brian Hartzinski and Sam Dupre produce the show, and our digital content intern is Ivy Dyson. For Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Corlott.